What did the Jews think of this Pentecost thing? Hero says. They were still running the country, right?
The Romans were running the country, the librarian says, but there were a number of Jewish religious authorities. At this time, there were three groups of Jews: the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes.
I remember the Pharisees from Jesus Christ Superstar. They were the ones with the deep voices who were always hassling Christ.
They were hassling him, the librarian says, because they were religiously very strict. They adhered to a strong legalistic version of the religion. To them, the law was everything. Clearly, Jesus was a threat to them because he was proposing, in effect, to do away with the law.
He wanted a contract renegotiation with God.
This sounds like an analogy which I am not very good at, but even if it is taken literally, it is true.
Who were the other two groups?
The Sadducees were materialists.
Meaning what? They drove BMWs?
No. Materialists in the philosophical sense. All philosophies are either monist or dualist. Monists believe that the material world is the only world, hence materialists. Dualists believe in a binary universe, that there is a spiritual world in addition to the material world.
Well, as a computer geek, I have to believe in the binary universe. The librarian raises his eyebrows.
How does that follow?
Sorry, it's a joke. A bad pun. See, computers use binary code to represent information, so I was joking that I have to believe in the binary universe, that I have to be a dualist.
How droll, the librarian says, not sounding very amused. Your joke may not be without genuine merit, however.
How's that? I was just kidding, really.
Computers rely on the one and the zero to represent all things. This distinction between something and nothing, this pivotal separation between being and non-being, is quite fundamental and underlies many creation myths.
Hero feels his face getting slightly warm, feels himself getting annoyed. He suspects that the librarian may be pulling his leg, playing him for a fool. But he knows that the librarian, however convincingly rendered he may be, is just a piece of software and cannot actually do such things.
Even the word science comes from an Indo-European root meaning to cut or to separate. The same root led to the word shit, which of course means to separate living flesh from non-living waste. The same root gave us scythe and scissors and schism, which have obvious connections to the concept of separation.
How about sword?
From a root with several meanings. One of those meanings is to cut or pierce. One of them is post or rod, and the other is simply to speak.
Let's stay on track, Hero says.
Fine. I can return to this potential conversation fork at a later time, if you desire.
I don't want to get all forked up at this point.
Tell me about the third group, the Essenes. They lived communally and believed that physical and spiritual cleanliness were intimately connected. They were constantly bathing themselves, lying naked under the sun, purging themselves with enemas, and going to extreme lengths to make sure that their food was pure and uncontaminated. They even had their own versions of the Gospels, in which Jesus healed possessed people not with miracles, but by driving parasites such as tapeworm out of their body. These parasites are considered to be synonymous with demons.
They sound kind of like hippies.
The connection has been made before, but it is faulty in many ways. The Essenes were strictly religious and would never have taken drugs.
So to them, there was no difference between infection with a parasite, like tapeworm, and demonic possession.
Correct.
Interesting. I wonder what they would have thought about computer viruses.
Speculation is not in my ambit.
Speaking of which, Lagos was babbling to me about viruses and infection and something called a Namshub. What does that mean?
Namshub is a word from Sumerian.
Sumerian?
Yes, sir.
used in Mesopotamia until roughly 2000 BC, the oldest of all written languages.
Oh, so all the other languages are descended from it.
For a moment, the librarian's eyes glance upward as if he's thinking about something. This is a visual cue to inform Hero that he's making a momentary raid on the library.
Actually, no, the librarian says. No languages whatsoever are descended from Sumerian. It is an agglutinative tongue, meaning that it is a collection of morphemes or syllables that are grouped into words. Very unusual.
You are saying, Hero says, remembering David in the hospital, that if I could hear someone speaking Sumerian, it would sound like a long stream of short syllables strung together?
Yes, sir.
Would it sound anything like glossolalia?
Judgment call. Ask someone real, the librarian says.
Does it sound like any modern tongue?
There is no provable genetic relationship between Sumerian and any tongue that came afterward.
That's odd. My Mesopotamian history is rusty, Hero says. What happened to the Sumerians? Genocide?
No, sir. They were conquered, but there's no evidence of genocide per se.
Everyone gets conquered sooner or later, Hero says. But their languages don't die out. Why did Sumerian disappear?
Since I'm just a piece of code, I would be on very thin ice to speculate, the librarian says.
Okay. Does anyone understand Sumerian?
Yes. At any given time, it appears that there are roughly 10 people in the world who can read it.
Where do they work?
One in Israel, one at the British Museum, one in Iraq, one at the University of Chicago, one at the University of Pennsylvania, and five at Rife Bible College in Houston, Texas.
Nice distribution. And have any of these people figured out what the word Namshub means in Sumerian?
Yes. A Namshub is a speech with magical force. The closest English equivalent would be incantation, but this has a number of incorrect connotations.
Did the Sumerians believe in magic?
The librarian shakes his head minutely.
This is the kind of seemingly precise question that is in fact very profound, and that pieces of software, such as myself, are notoriously clumsy at. Allow me to quote from Kramer, Samuel Noah, and Mayer, John R. Myths of Enki, the Crafty God, New York, Oxford, Oxford University Press, 1989. Quote, "Religion, magic, and medicine are so completely intertwined in Mesopotamia that separating them is frustrating and perhaps futile work. Sumerian incantations demonstrate an intimate connection between the religious, the magical, and the aesthetic, so complete that any attempt to pull one away from the other will distort the whole." End quote. There is more material in here that might help explain the subject.
In where?
In the next room, the librarian says, gesturing at the wall. He walks over and slides the rice paper partition out of the way.
A speech with magical force.
Nowadays, people don't believe in these kinds of things. Except in the metaverse, that is, where magic is possible. The metaverse is a fictional structure made out of code, and code is just a form of speech, the form that computers understand. The metaverse in its entirety could be considered a single vast Namshub, enacting itself on L. Bob Reif's fiber optic network.
The voice phone rings. Just a second, Hero says.
Take your time, the librarian says, not adding the obvious reminder that he can wait for a million years if need be.
Me again, Whitey says. I'm still on the train. Stumps got off at Expressport 127.
That's the antipode of downtown. I mean, it's as far away from downtown as you can get.
It is?
Yeah. 127 is 2 to the 7th power minus 1.
Spare me, I take your word for it.
It's definitely out in the middle of fucking nowhere, she says.
You didn't get off and follow him?
Are you kidding? All the way out here? It's 10,000 miles from the nearest building, Hero.
She has a point. The metaverse was built with plenty of room to expand. Almost all of the development is within 2 or 3 express ports.
500 kilometers or so of downtown. Port 127 is 20,000 miles away. What is there?
A black cube exactly 20 miles in size.
Totally black?
Yeah.
How can you measure a black cube that big?
I'm riding along looking at the stars, okay? Suddenly, I can't see them anymore on the right side of the train. I start counting local ports. I count 16 of them. We get to Expressport 127, and Stumpy climbs off and goes toward the black thing. I count 16 more local ports, and then the stars come out. Then I take 32 kilometers and multiply it by 0.6, and I get 20 miles. You asshole.
That's good, Hero says. That's good intel.
Who do you think owns a black cube 20 miles across?
Just going on pure irrational bias, I'm guessing L. Bob Reife. Supposedly, he has a big hunk of real estate out in the middle of nowhere where he keeps all the guts of the metaverse. Some of us used to smash into it occasionally when we were out racing motorcycles.
Well, gotta go, Pod.
Hiro hangs up and walks into the new room. The librarian follows. It's about 50 feet on a side. The center of the space is occupied by three large artifacts, or rather, three-dimensional renderings of artifacts. In the center is a thick slab of baked clay, hanging in space, about the size of a coffee table and about a foot thick. Hiro suspects that it is a magnified rendering of a smaller object. The broad surfaces of the slab are entirely covered with angular writing that Hiro recognizes as cuneiform. Around the edges are rounded parallel depressions that appear to have been made by fingers as they shape the slab. To the right of the slab is a wooden pole with branches on top, sort of a stylized tree. To the left of the slab is an 8-foot-high obelisk, also covered with cuneiform, with a bas-relief figure chiseled into the top. The figure shows a seated man handing another man what looks like a stick and a hoop. The room is filled with a 3-dimensional constellation of hypercards hanging weightlessly in the air. It looks like a high-speed photograph of a blizzard in progress. In some places, the hypercards are placed in precise geometric patterns, like atoms in a crystal. In other places, whole stacks of them are clumped together. Drifts of them have accumulated in the corners, as though Lagos tossed them away when he was finished. Hiro finds that his avatar can walk right through the hypercards without disturbing the arrangement. It is, in fact, the 3-dimensional counterpart of a messy desktop, all the trash still remaining wherever Lagos left it. The cloud of hypercards extends to every corner of the 50-by-50-foot space and from floor level all the way up to about 8 feet, which is about as high as Lagos's avatar could reach.
How many hypercards in here?
10,463, the librarian says.
I don't really have time to go through them, Hiro says. Can you give me some idea of what Lagos was working on here?
Well, I can read back the names of all the cards if you'd like. Lagos grouped them into 4 broad categories: biblical studies, Sumerian studies, neurolinguistic studies, and intel gathered on L. Bob Reife.
Without going into that kind of detail, what did Lagos have on his mind? What was he getting at?
What do I look like, a psychologist? The librarian says. I can't answer those kinds of questions.
Let me try it again. How does this stuff connect, if at all, to the subject of viruses?
The connections are elaborate. Summarizing them would require both creativity and discretion. As a mechanical entity, I have neither.
How old is this stuff? Hiro says, gesturing to the 3 artifacts.
The clay envelope is Sumerian. It is from the 3rd millennium BC. It was dug up from the city of Eridu in southern Iraq. The black steel, or obelisk, is the Code of Hammurabi, which dates from about 1750 BC. The tree-like structure is a Yahwistic cult totem from Palestine. It is called an Asherah,
It's from about 900 BC.
Did you call that slab an envelope?
Yes. It has a smaller clay slab wrapped up inside of it. This was how the Sumerians made tamper-proof documents.
All these things are in a museum somewhere, I take it.
The Asherah and the Code of Hammurabi are in museums. The clay envelope is in the personal collection of Elbab Reif.
Elbab Reif is obviously interested in this stuff.
Reif Bible College, which he founded, has the richest archaeology department in the world. They have been conducting a dig in Eridu, which was the cult center of a Sumerian god named Enki.
How are these things related to each other? The librarian raises his eyebrows.
I'm sorry?
Well, let's try process of elimination. Do you know why Lagos found Sumerian writings interesting, as opposed to, say, Greek or Egyptian?
Egypt was a civilization of stone. They made their art and architecture of stone, so it lasts forever. But you can't write on stone. So they invented papyrus and wrote on that. But papyrus is perishable. So even though their art and architecture have survived, their written records, their data, have largely disappeared.
What about all those hieroglyphic inscriptions?
Bumper stickers, Lagos called them. Corrupt political speech. They had an unfortunate tendency to write inscriptions praising their own military victories before the battles had actually taken place.
And Sumer is different?
Sumer was a civilization of clay. They made their buildings of it and wrote on it, too. Their statues were of gypsum, which dissolves in water. So the buildings and statues have since fallen apart under the elements. But the clay tablets were either baked or else buried in jars. So all the data of the Sumerians have survived. Egypt left a legacy of art and architecture. Sumer's legacy is its megabytes.
How many megabytes?
As many as archaeologists bother to dig up. The Sumerians wrote on everything. When they built a building, they would write in cuneiform on every brick. When the buildings fell down, these bricks would remain scattered across the desert. In the Quran, the angels who are sent to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah say, quote, "We are sent forth to a wicked nation, so that we may bring down on them a shower of clay stones, marked by your Lord for the destruction of the sinful." End quote. Lagos found this interesting. This promiscuous dispersal of information written on a medium that lasts forever. He spoke of pollen blowing in the wind. I gather that this was some kind of analogy.
It was. Tell me, has the inscription on this clay envelope been translated?
Yes. It is a warning. It says, quote, "This envelope contains the Namshub of Enki." End quote.
I know what a Namshub is. What is the Namshub of Enki?
The librarian stares off into the distance and clears his throat dramatically.
Once upon a time, there was no snake, there was no scorpion, there was no hyena, there was no lion, there was no wild dog, no wolf, there was no fear, no terror. Man had no rival. In those days, the land Shubar Hamazi, Harmony Tongue Sumer, the great land of the May of Princeship, Yuri, the land having all that is appropriate, the land Martu, resting in security, the whole universe, the people well cared for, to Enlil in one tongue gave speech. Then the Lord Defiant, the Prince Defiant, the King Defiant, Enki, the Lord of Abundance, whose commands are trustworthy, the Lord of Wisdom, who scans the land, the leader of the gods, the Lord of Eridu, endowed with wisdom, changed the speech in their mouths, put contention into it, into the speech of man that had been won. That is Kramer's translation.
That's a story, Hero says. I thought a Namshub was an incantation.
The Namshub of Enki is both a story and an incantation, the librarian says. A self-fulfilling fiction. Lagos believed
that in its original form, which this translation only hints at, it actually did what it describes.
You mean, change the speech in men's mouths?
Yes, the librarian says.
This is a Babel story, isn't it? Hero says. Everyone was speaking the same language, and then Enki changed their speech so that they could no longer understand each other. This must be the basis for the Tower of Babel stuff in the Bible.
This room contains a number of cards tracing that connection, the librarian says.
You mentioned before that, at one point, everyone spoke Sumerian. Then nobody did. It just vanished like the dinosaurs. And there's no genocide to explain how that happened, which is consistent with the Tower of Babel story and the Nam-Shub of Enki. Did Lagos think that Babel really happened?
He was sure of it. He was quite concerned about the vast number of human languages. He felt there were simply too many of them.
How many?
Tens of thousands. In many parts of the world, you will find people of the same ethnic group living a few miles apart in similar valleys under similar conditions, speaking languages that have absolutely nothing in common with each other. This sort of thing is not an oddity. It is ubiquitous. Many linguists have tried to understand Babel, the question of why human language tends to fragment rather than converging on a common tongue.
Has anyone come up with an answer yet?
The question is difficult and profound, the librarian says. Lagos had a theory.
Yes?
He believed that Babel was an actual historical event, that it happened in a particular time and place, coinciding with the disappearance of the Sumerian language, that prior to Babel/Infocalypse, languages tended to converge, and that afterward, languages have always had an innate tendency to diverge and become mutually incomprehensible. That this tendency is, as he put it, coiled like a serpent around the human brainstem.
The only thing that could explain that is... Hero stops, not wanting to say it.
Yes,
the librarian says. If there was some phenomenon that moved through the population, altering their minds in such a way that they couldn't process the Sumerian language anymore, kind of in the same way that a virus moves from one computer to another, damaging each computer in the same way, coiling around the brainstem.
Lagos devoted much time and effort to this idea, the librarian says. He felt that the Nam-Shub of Enki was a neurolinguistic virus.
And that this Enki character was a real personage?
Possibly.
And that Enki invented this virus and spread it throughout Sumer using tablets like this one?
Yes. A tablet has been discovered containing a letter to Enki in which the writer complains about it.
A letter to a god?
Yes. It is from Sin-Samu, the scribe. He begins by praising Enki and emphasizing his devotion to him. Then he complains. Quote, like a young... The line is broken here. I am paralyzed at the wrist. Like a wagon on the road when its yoke has split, I stand immobile on the road. I lay on a bed called Oh, and Oh No. I let out a wail. My graceful figure is stretched neck to ground. I am paralyzed afoot. Has been carried off into the earth. My frame has changed. At night I cannot sleep. My strength has been struck down. My life is ebbing away. The bright day is made a dark day for me. I have slipped into my own grave. I, a writer who knows many things, am made a fool. My hand has stopped writing. There is no talk in my mouth. End quote. After more description of his woes, the scribe ends with, quote, my God, it is you I fear. I have written you a letter. Take pity on me. The heart of my God. Have it given back to me. End quote.
Ambangala Manuralari. 17. 17. me.
29. YT is maxing in a mom's truck stop on 405, waiting for her ride. Not that she would ever be caught dead at a mom's truck stop. If, like, a semi ran her over with all 18 of its wheels in front of a mom's truck stop, she would drag herself down the shoulder of the highway, using her eyelid muscles until she reached a snooze and cruise full of horny derelicts rather than go into a mom's truck stop. But sometimes when you're a professional, they give you a job that you don't like, and you just have to be very cool and put up with it. For purposes of this evening's job, the man with the glass eye has already supplied her with a driver and security person, as he put it. A totally unknown quantity. YT isn't sure she likes putting up with some mystery guy. She has this image in her mind that he's going to be like the wrestling coach at the high school. That would be so gratendous. Anyway, this is where she's supposed to meet him. YT orders a coffee and a slice of cherry pie a la mode. She carries them over to the public street terminal back in the corner. It is sort of a wrap-around stainless steel booth stuck between a phone booth, which has a homesick truck driver poured into it, and a pinball machine, which features a chick with big boobs that light up when you shoot the ball up the magic fallopians. She's not that good at the metaverse, but she knows her way around, and she's got an address. And finding an address in the metaverse shouldn't be any more difficult than doing it in reality, at least if you're not a totally retarded ped. As soon as she steps out into the street, people start giving her these looks. The same kind of looks that people give her when she walks through the worsted wool desolation of the Westlake Corporate Park in her dynamic blue and orange courier gear. She knows that the people in the street are giving her dirty looks because she's just coming in from a shitty public terminal. She's a trashy black and white person. The built-up part of the street, around Port Zero, forms a luminescent thunderhead off to her right. She puts her back to it and climbs onto the monorail. She'd like to go into town, but that's an expensive part of the street to visit, and she'd be dumping money into the coin slot about every 0.1 millisecond. The guy's name is Ing. In reality, he is somewhere in Southern California. YT isn't sure exactly what he is driving. Some kind of van full of what the man with the glass eye described as
stuff. Really incredible stuff that you don't need to know about.
In the metaverse, he lives outside of town around Port 2, where things really start to spread out. Ing's metaverse home is a French colonial villa in the pre-war village of Mai To in the Mekong Delta. Visiting him is like going to Vietnam in about 1955, except that you don't have to get all sweaty. In order to make room for this creation, he has laid claim to a patch of metaverse space a couple of miles off the street. There's no monorail service in this low-rent development, so YT's avatar has to walk the entire way. He has a large office with French doors and a balcony looking out over endless rice paddies where little Vietnamese people work. Clearly, this guy is a fairly hardcore techie, because YT counts hundreds of people out in his rice paddies, plus dozens more running around the village, all of them fairly well rendered and all of them doing different things. She's not a bidhead, but she knows that this guy is throwing a lot of computer time into the task of creating a realistic view out his office window. And the fact that it's Vietnam makes it twisted and spooky. YT can't wait to tell Roadkill about this place. She wonders if it has bombings and strafings and napalm drops. That would be the best. Ing himself, or at least Ing's avatar, is a small, very dapper Vietnamese man in his 50s, hair plastered to his head, wearing military-style khakis. At the time YT comes into his office, he is leaning forward in his chair, getting his shoulders rubbed by a geisha. A geisha in Vietnam? YT's grandpa, who was there for a while, told her that the Nipponese took over Vietnam during the war and treated it with the cruelty that was their trademark before we nuked them and they discovered that they were pacifists. The Vietnamese, like most other Asians, hate the Japanese. And apparently this Ing character gets a kick out of the idea of having a Japanese geisha around to rub his back. But it is a very strange thing to do. For one reason, the geisha is just a picture on Ing's goggles,
and on YTs. And you can't get a massage from a picture, so why bother? When YT comes in, Ing stands up and bows. This is how hardcore street wackos greet each other. They don't like to shake hands because you can't actually feel the contact, and it reminds you that you're not even really there.
Yeah, hi, YT says.
Ing sits back down, and the geisha goes right back to it. Ing's desk is a nice French antique with a row of small television monitors along the back edge, facing toward him. He spends most of his time watching the monitors, even when he is talking.
They told me a little bit about you, Ing says.
Shouldn't listen to nasty rumors, YT says.
Ing picks up a glass from his desk and takes a drink from it. It looks like a mint julep. Globes of condensation form on its surface, break loose, and trickle down the side. The rendering is so perfect that YT can see a miniaturized reflection of the office windows in each drop of condensation. It's just totally ostentatious. What a bithead. He is looking at her with a totally emotionless face, but YT imagines that it is a face of hate and disgust. To spend all this money on the coolest house in the metaverse and then have some skater come in done up in grainy black and white? It must be a real kick in the metaphorical nuts. Somewhere in this house, a radio is going, playing a mix of Vietnamese loungy type stuff and Yank wheelchair rock.
Are you a Nova Sicilia citizen?
Ing says.
No, I just chill sometimes with Uncle Enzo and the other mafia dudes.
Ah, very unusual.
Ing is not a man in a hurry. He has soaked up the languid pace of the Mekong Delta and is content to sit there and watch his TV sets and fire off a sentence every few minutes. Another thing, he apparently has Tourette syndrome or some other brain woes because from time to time, for no apparent reason, he makes strange noises with his mouth. They have the twangy sound that you always hear from Vietnamese when they're in the back rooms of stores and restaurants, carrying on family disputes in the mother tongue. But as far as YT can tell, they aren't real words, just sound effects.
Do you work a lot for these guys? YT asks.
Occasional small security jobs. Unlike most large corporations, the mafia has a strong tradition of handling its own security arrangements. But when something especially technical is called for...
He pauses in the middle of this sentence to make an incredible zooming sound in his nose.
Is that your thing? Security?
Ing scans all of his TV sets. He snaps his fingers, and the geisha scurries out of the room. He folds his hands together on his desk and leans forward. He stares at YT.
Yes, he says.
YT looks back at him for a bit, waiting for him to continue. After a few seconds, his attention drifts back to the monitors.
I do most of my work under a large contract with Mr. Lee, he blurts.
YT is waiting for the continuation of the sentence. Not Mr. Lee, but Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong.
Oh, well. If she can drop Uncle Enzo's name, he can drop Mr. Lee's.
The social structure of any nation-state is ultimately determined by its security arrangements, Ing says, and Mr. Lee understands this.
Oh, wow, we're going to be profound now. Ing is suddenly talking just like the old white men on the TV pundit powwows which Whitey's mother watches obsessively.
Instead of hiring a large human security force, which impacts the social environment, you know, lots of minimum wage earners standing around carrying machine guns, Mr. Lee prefers to use non-human systems.
Non-human systems. White is about to ask him, what do you know about the rat thing?
But it is pointless, he won't say. It would get their relationship off on the wrong foot, YT asking Ing for intel, intel that he would never give her, and that would make the whole scene even weirder than it is now, which YT can't even imagine. Ing bursts forth with a long string of twangy noises, pops, and glottal stops.
Fucking bitch, he mumbles.
Excuse me?
Nothing, he says. A bimbo box cut me off.
None of these people understand that with this vehicle, I could crush them like a pot-bellied pig under an armored personnel carrier.
A bimbo box? You're driving?
Yes. I'm coming to pick you up, remember?
Do you mind?
No, he sighs, as if he really does. YT gets up and walks around behind his desk to look. Each of the little TV monitors is showing a different view out his van. Windshield, left window, rear view. Another one has an electronic map showing his position, inbound on the San Bernardino, not far away.
The van is under voice command, he explains. I removed the steering wheel and pedal interface because I found verbal commands more convenient. This is why I will sometimes make unfamiliar sounds with my voice. I am controlling the vehicle systems.
YT signs off from the metaverse for a while to clear her head and take a leak. When she takes off the goggles, she discovers that she has built up quite an audience of truckers and mechanics who are standing around the terminal booth in a semicircle listening to her jabber at Ing. When she stands up, attention shifts to her butt, naturally. YT hits the bathroom, finishes her pie, and wanders out into the ultraviolet glare of the setting sun to wait for Ing. Recognizing his van is easy enough. It is enormous. It is 8 feet high and wider than it is high, which would have made it a wide load in the old days when they had laws. The construction is boxy and angular. It has been welded together out of the type of flat, dimpled steel plate usually used to make manhole lids and stair treads. The tires are huge, like tractor tires, with a more subtle tread, and there are six of them, two axles in back and one in front. The engine is so big that, like an evil spaceship in a movie, YT feels its rumbling in her ribs before she can see it. It is kicking out diesel exhaust through a pair of squat, vertical red smokestacks that project from the roof toward the rear. The windshield is a perfectly flat rectangle of glass about 3 by 8 feet, smoke so black that YT can't make out an outline of anything inside. The snout of the van is festooned with every type of high-powered light known to science, like this guy hit a new South Africa franchise on a Saturday night and stole every light off every roll bar, and a grill has been constructed across the front, welded together out of rails torn out of an abandoned railroad somewhere. The grill alone probably weighs more than a small car. The passenger door swings open. YT walks over and climbs into the front seat.
Hi, she is saying. You need to take a whiz or anything?
Ing isn't there. Or maybe he is. Where the driver's seat ought to be, there is a sort of neoprene pouch about the size of a garbage can, suspended from the ceiling by a web of straps, shock cords, tubes, wires, fiber optic cables, and hydraulic lines. It is swathed in so much stuff that it is hard to make out its actual outlines. At the top of this pouch, YT can see a patch of skin with some black hair around it, the top of a balding man's head. Everything else, from the temples downward, is encased in an enormous goggle-slash-mask-slash-headphone-slash-feeding-tube unit held onto his head by smart straps that are constantly tightening and loosening themselves to keep the device comfortable and properly positioned. Below this, on either side, where you'd sort of expect to see arms, huge bundles of wires, fiber optics, and tubes run up out of the floor and are seemingly plugged into Ing's shoulder sockets. There is a similar arrangement where his legs are supposed to be attached, and more stuff going into his groin and hooked up to various locations on his torso. The entire thing is swathed in a one-piece coverall, a pouch larger than his torso ought to be, that is constantly bulging and throbbing as though alive.
Thank you. All my needs are taken care of, Ing says.
The door slams shut behind her. Ing makes a yapping sound, and the van pulls out onto the frontage road, headed back toward 405.
Please excuse my appearance, he says after a couple of awkward minutes. My helicopter caught fire during the evacuation of Saigon in 1974. A stray tracer from ground forces.
Whoa, what a drag.
I was able to reach an American aircraft carrier off the coast, but, you know, the fuel was spraying around quite a bit during the fire.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I tried prosthesis for a while. Some of them are very good. But nothing is as good as a motorized wheelchair. And then I got to thinking, why do motorized wheelchairs always have to be tiny, pathetic things that strain to go up a little teeny ramp?
So I bought this. It is an airport fire truck from Germany, and converted it into my new motorized wheelchair.
It's very nice.
America is wonderful because you can get anything on a drive-through basis. Oil change, liquor, banking, car wash, funerals, anything you want. Drive-through. So this vehicle is much better than a tiny, pathetic wheelchair. It is an extension of my body.
When the geisha rubs your back? Ing mumbles something, and his pouch begins to throb and undulate around his body.
She's a demon, of course. As for the massage, my body is suspended in an electrocontractive gel that massages me when I need it. I also have a Swedish girl and an African woman, but those demons are not as well rendered.
And the mint julep?
Through a feeding tube. Non-alcoholic.
So, YT says at some point, when they are way past LAX and she figures it's too late to chicken out.
What's the plan?
Do we have a plan?
We go to Long Beach, to the Terminal Island Sacrifice Zone, and we buy some drugs, Ing says.
Or you do, actually, since I am indisposed.
That's my job? To buy some drugs? Buy them and throw them up in the air.
In a sacrifice zone?
Yes, and we'll take care of the rest.
Who's we, dude?
There are several more, entities that will help us.
What? Is the back of the van full of more, people like you?
Sort of, Ing says. You are close to the truth.
Would these be, like, non-human systems?
That is a sufficiently all-inclusive term, I think.
YT figures that for a big yes. You tired? Want me to drive or anything? Ing laughs sharply, like distant ack-ack, and the van almost swerves off the road. YT doesn't get the sense that he is laughing at the joke. He is laughing at what a jerk YT is.